Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation, paving the way for fresh elections and opening a new chapter of political uncertainty. The Kremlin says Western sanctions imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine will not make it change course. And in Sri Lanka, veteran politician Ranil Wickremesinghe is sworn in as the new president amid an unprecedented economic crisis. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi resigns from his post, paving the way for snap election in a country engulfed in political turmoil for several days now. Draghi tendered his resignation after three coalition parties withdrew the support for his government. Draghi is now set to act as caretaker until the elections are held. The Italian Prime Minister had already tendered his resignation last week after the Five Star Movement failed to back him in a confidence vote on measures tackling the high cost of living. But President Sergio Mattarella rejected the resignation and told him to go before Parliament to see if he could keep the broad coalition going. Draghi's departure can lead to national elections as early as September or October. He'd been the Prime Minister since February 2021. Russia has resumed sending gas through its biggest pipeline to Europe after a 10-day maintenance period. Flows via the Nord Stream 1 link connecting Russia to Germany restarted on Thursday. Germany has confirmed the resumption of the gas delivery, however, it did not specify details regarding how much gas was being delivered. On Wednesday, the head of Germany's energy regulator said the pipeline would resume at around 30% capacity, 10% lower than the pre-maintenance period. Nord Stream 1 is one of the main sources of gas to Europe. The bloc was concerned that Russia would extend maintenance.
The European Commission is asking EU member states to reduce demand for gas by 15% until spring. For now, this is just a request, but the Commission warns it might well become a demand.
The 15% are aspirational. It's a voluntary goal. It's aspirational. And in case that we are in an emergency, then the target becomes binding.
The EU claims it's concerned that Russia will cut off all gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions imposed by the West over the war in Ukraine.
Shortfalls will not just affect the countries where the shortfalls happen. They will affect every single member state because they will have serious consequences on our economy. And nobody can escape that consequence.
The truth is, Russia has fulfilled all its energy supply contracts to the EU and vows to continue doing so. Some analysts believe the US and its transnational companies are behind the hysteria because they want to take business from Russia's Gazprom Energy Corporation.
The whole rhetoric today is based on imaginary threat, which was never confirmed by Russian authorities, because on contrary, Russian authorities said on many occasions, and including the President Putin, that Gazprom will honour their contracts.
Since Russia's so-called special military operation was launched in Ukraine last February, the EU has been importing large amounts of liquefied natural gas from the United States. It's an expensive process. The bloc is also signing contracts with countries in Africa and the Middle East.
During a technical briefing here for journalists, officials confirmed to me there has been no contact with Iran on increasing EU energy supplies, despite the Islamic Republic having enormous oil and gas reserves. In this regard, analysts say the EU continues to bow to US pressure, and it's ordinary citizens who are paying the price for that. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
Russia blames the U.S. for hampering peace talks with Ukraine, ruling out any contact with Washington over the negotiations.
The reason is obvious. It is the destructive policy of U.S. President Joe Biden, who has declared his goal as the defeat of Russia in Ukraine. The American administration forbids its team in Kyiv to even think about talks with us, and evidently forces them to fight to the last Ukrainian. What can we discuss with the United States of America under these conditions?
On Wednesday, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the talks to reach a truce over Ukraine make no sense. Ukraine hit back, saying that Russia is not seeking peace. Negotiations to put an end to the war have come to a halt since early April. That is when the two sides held talks in the Turkish city of Istanbul. The Ukraine war began on February 24. The West, especially the U.S., has supplied Ukraine with arms and has imposed sanctions on Russia, targeting its economy. Moscow, however, says that even the harshest sanctions would never make it change course. Now to Sri Lanka, where Ranil Wickremesinghe has been sworn in as the country's new president. The six-time prime minister took the oath of office on Thursday before the Chief Justice. On Wednesday, he won a comfortable victory in Parliament. The vote came after protesters forced President Gotabaya Rajapaksa from office amid anger over a spiraling economic crisis. Wickremesinghe faces a tough road ahead as Sri Lanka continues to be crippled by the worst economic crisis since independence, with shortages of food and fuel. The executive director at Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Johan Pereira, thinks that the new president is a man of, quote, great experience, who might be able to lead the country out of the crisis it's in.
There are two elements to the protest movement. One is the hardcore group of protesters who have been camping daily for the past 4 months. They are young people. They are more from a leftist background. They are university students. And they are insisting, at this moment, they are insisting that the newly elected president should step down, because they feel that this election is not a legitimate one. It is by a parliament elected 3 years ago who have lost their mandate because of their misgovernance of the country. But this parliament has now elected a new president. However, I believe that because the new president is indeed a man of great experience, he has been prime minister on six previous occasions, including this one, and he is a very cultured man, very well educated, knows the ways of the world, negotiates and is a good negotiator. They feel that he might be able to, now that he's president, make a change. So I think the bulk of the people who also join the protest movement, when they are called upon and when they feel it's necessary, will want to give the new president a chance.
The Iranian president has hosted his Turkish and Russian counterparts on Tuesday for a summit on the crisis in Syria. As much as Syria was the focus of the gathering, there was another positive result to come out of the summit: how Iran, Russia, and Turkey can solve regional issues on their own. One of the challenges, however, was how to convince Turkey not to pursue its military operation against the Kurds in northern Syria. And that is what Iran's leader conveyed to the Turkish president.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-à-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognised there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The Astana process has been an ongoing trilateral cooperation meant to solve the Syrian crisis that has been dragging on because of the U.S. and its allies' hostility against the Syrian government. Now the only remaining parties that illegally are remaining in Syria are the U.S. and the terrorists. Damascus has accused Washington of plundering the Syrian nation's resources, including oil, while the Syrians are under U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Turkey has accused the U.S. of supporting terrorists. Iran has said the U.S. is a source of instability in Syria.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Принятым совместным заявлением подтверждена приверженность укреплению трехстороннего сотрудничества России, Ирана и Турции в интересах достижения устойчивой и жизнеспособной нормализации ситуации в Сирийской Арабской Республике.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the US out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the US is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
Iran's top human rights official has denounced what he calls the contradictory behavior and the double standard policies of some European countries toward the Islamic Republic. The Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights made the comments in protest at a Swedish court ruling against Iranian national Hamid Nouri. Kazem Gharibabadi called the verdict unlawful, saying that Tehran will not sit idly by and has several options on the table to respond. Gharibabadi said that Sweden claims to be behaving based on mutual respect, but hosts and supports anti-Iran terror groups. Last week, a Swedish court sentenced Nouri to life in prison over alleged rights abuses against members of the Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, known as the MKO, in the 1980s. The MKO is a terror group responsible for thousands of deaths in Iran.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how these angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nouri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardash prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mujahideen Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Audio file of an alleged Nouri phone conversation from prison shows that he was prevented from visiting an ophthalmologist despite his worsening eye condition. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, supporters of Liz Truss have said her key rival Penny Mordaunt has topped out of backers as the Foreign Secretary gained ground in the fight for second place in the Conservative leadership contest. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Jessica Elgott, Aubrey Allegretti and Peter Walker. The piece is titled Truss Camp Says Mordaunt Has Topped Out, with Tugendhat Latest to Fall. In Britain, supporters of Liz Truss have said her key rival Penny Mordaunt has topped out of backers as the Foreign Secretary gained ground in the fight for second place in the Conservative leadership contest. Penny Mordaunt lost the vote in the latest ballot of Tory MPs, a key sign her campaign had stalled after a weekend of bruising attacks, but remained behind frontrunner Rishi Sunak. But the pressure is still on Liz Truss, who gained just seven MP backers less than the fourth place Kemi Badenoch, who received 9 new supporters. Tom Tugendhat, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, was knocked out of the race. James Cleverly, the Education Secretary, said Liz Truss had shown during the leadership debates that she was ready for the job. "This is about day one competence. She's showing she has always had the best depth and best breadth of experience," he added. The remaining leadership hopefuls will now be hoping to pick off Tom Tugendhat's 31 supporters. A Liz Truss backer said that Mordaunt's support was strong, but they believe she and Badenoch would not ultimately be able to overcome their relative lack of experience to win the chance to face off with Rishi Sunak in the final two. Sunak launched a crime policy blitz on Tuesday, 19th of July, pledging to introduce a new offence for belonging to or facilitating abuse by grooming gangs, as well as a new offence for taking so-called down-blousing pictures. He also proposed making it an aggravating factor in sentencing if criminals refuse to appear in court, and review sentence guidelines for crimes against women and girls. In his final pitch, the Tory MPs Tom Tugendhat used his speech to warn that the party was on the brink of a 1997-style wipeout in the next general election. "The country is looking for a change, looking for a break from the past, and if we can't deliver that change, then Labour will," he warned MPs at the Closed Doors 1922 committee hustings. "The threat we face is existential," he said. Tugendhat added, "The public no longer believes us. We wouldn't be having this leadership race. We wouldn't be so behind in the polls if we had not lost the British people's faith." The MP said he had been offered jobs in future administrations if he dropped out of the race, but he wanted to see party democracy run its course. "It's not my job to decide. It is yours," he told MPs. "That is the nature of democracy, that I give you the choice rather than taking it from you. I have deplored the infighting, the sniping, the blue on blue, the attacks and the smears. We do not need this now or ever," he added. Tom Tugendhat's defeat meant that 4 remaining candidates turned attention away from fighting for survival and instead to the final 2 ballots of Tory MPs. Candidates will be specially keen to court the Tugendhat backers, Jake Berry and Anne-Marie Trevelyan, key endorsements from the Northern Research Group caucus of Red Wall Tories. Anne-Marie Trevelyan, the International Trade Secretary, has been critical of Penny Mordaunt's time in her department. "Understandably, perhaps, now it's clear Penny has for the last few months spent some of her time focused on preparing her leadership campaign, for which I have utmost respect. That's how this system works," Trevelyan told LBC. "There have been a number of times when she hasn't been available, which would have been useful, and other ministers have picked up the pieces," she added. Rishi Sunak gained 14 supporters from the last ballot to put him on a total of 115, trailed by Penny Mordaunt, who lost 1 supporter, giving her a total of 82. Liz Truss remained in third place, picking up 7 supporters to put her on 71. Kemi Badenoch came fourth with an extra 9 supporters, giving her a total of 58. As the race narrowed, MPs said Badenoch and Mordaunt were most likely to benefit from a tussle between the factions trying to keep Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss from making the final 2. Though Sunak retained a relatively comfortable position as frontrunner, his team was still said to be furiously ringing around wavering MPs. "I don't think he's going to have that massive majority where he can go to the country and be the dominating candidate," said one Tugendhat supporter, who said they were likely to support Liz Truss after Monday's vote. "That's going to undermine his position, because as a former chancellor, for him to go on level pegging That's damning. Another Togan Hatbaka said, Rishi's people are worried. They should be clear. They shouldn't be worried about MP numbers. But they are trying to grab us quite hard. They should be shaping who's against rather than bolstering his own numbers. Some of the ousted MP's supporters said they would meet after a vote for a commiseration drink and discuss with each other who to back. Several talked up the prospect of supporting Penny Mordaunt as the change candidate. The final three candidates, after the next round of voting takes place at mid-afternoon on Tuesday, 19th of July, had been expected to appear at a third television debate hosted by Sky News. But the debate was cancelled after Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss pulled out of the event after a bruising set of exchanges in the first two debates. Earlier, a source in Rishi Sunak's campaign said the former Chancellor had never committed to participating in the debate, adding, "We're very happy to do more debates if we're lucky enough to get to the next stage, including Sky News." Liz Truss's aides had said the Foreign Secretary was unlikely to take part if all the other candidates did not. The cancellation follows sometimes brutal exchanges in television debates on Friday and Sunday over taxation plans and about social issues. While Rishi Sunak has faced the brunt of the attacks on the former subject, Penny Mordaunt has been repeatedly criticised for supposedly being too liberal. After Sky News cancelled the debate, a spokesperson for Penny Mordaunt said, "It's a shame some colleagues cannot find a way to debate one another in a civil way." That quote was later deleted, with the spokesperson instead saying the candidate hopes there will be ample opportunity for such scrutiny later on in the contest. Conservative MPs voted against a confidence motion in the government on Monday evening, 18th of July, with several giving speeches praising Boris Johnson.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام من ذكر رجلا من خلفه بما هو فيه مما عرفه الناس لم يغتبه ومن ذكره من خلفه بما هو فيه مما لا يعرفه الناس اغتابه.
Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام stated, he who talks about someone behind his back, mentioning what is true about him and what people already know, then he has not backbite about him. Whereas he who talks about someone behind his back, about something that is true, but that people do not know about, then he has backbit about him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when talking about the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, of course, the seventh divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he talked about certain words of wisdom, which really leaves one astounded. Because these words of wisdom are such that, of course they are words of wisdom, but they are so true, and the more you think about them, the truer they become. The more you contemplate and reflect, you realize that these are truly incredibly true words. Now, why would they not be incredibly true and precise and accurate to perfection, these words of these divinely appointed imams, since first and foremost, they have been divinely appointed by Allah, and two, the source of their knowledge and their wisdom, of course, is the ultimate source of knowledge and wisdom, which is the Almighty, the All-Knowing Allah. And so in one of these conversations that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam had with his companions, he talked about a certain thing which brings about old age. Now, some of us, for some reason, because we live in a very materialistic frame of mind, we think that old age comes about via age itself, right? Or it comes about via an unhealthy lifestyle, or old age comes about, from working too much. In one place, I even read that running a lot, running actually increases a person's age as well. Here, there's something really interesting, and we have to take into consideration that this conversation between Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam and his companion occurred, well over 1,000 years ago. So many, if not perhaps all, of the modern-day sciences and the modern-day knowledge of these sciences that we have at hand today were totally not available, over 1,000 years ago. I mean, they didn't even exist in the shape and form that they exist in today. But in this conversation, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, many worries brings about old age. What a beautiful statement, and what a true, true statement. I mean, it's so true that is perfect. which is what we had said in the beginning of the segment, that their statements are true to perfection. And truly, you will find that an individual who has a lot of worries, who has a lot of stress, who is preoccupied with the issues and matters and the problems and the hardships of life, this will bring about old age. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Al-Kadhim is famous for this particular emphasis during his time. What he wanted to do was he saw there was a great deal of moral corruption. There was attachment to this world. The Abbasid caliphs were engrossed in the materialistic possessions of this world. They were drinking intoxicants. They were spending their time illegitimately with women. They were spreading fahisha and fahsha. And the Imam alayhi salam rose to the challenge to correct this type of actions that were there and to spread these important teachings, which highlight the need for you and I to hold ourselves accountable and to practice muhasaba every single day. Imam alayhi salam is telling us that without practicing this muhasaba, this self-accountability, one cannot be considered a follower of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. Why? The Quran comes forward and says, "Kafa bi nafsika al-yawma 'alayka hasiba." Sallallahu alayhi Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Imam Salamullahi alayhi says, when you hold yourself accountable every single day, that will allow you to strengthen your willpower, the power to say no to temptations, to desires, to the whims that you and I may have every single day when we're presented with all these challenges. Imam alayhi salam saw this particular opportunity to remind you and I of the importance of self-accountability. And he goes on to say that when it comes to this important action of muhasaba, one should reflect. If I have done a good deed, I should strengthen the resolve to continue performing it and to do more and more. But if, God forbid, I have committed an evil vice or a sin or an act of transgression against the Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the effort should be made and the commitment should be placed for that not to be repeated.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The refusal of Arab countries in the region to join the United States in exerting pressure on Russia over Ukraine. The political conflicts between Moscow and Tel Aviv over the military presence of the Zionist regime in Syria. The emergence of new military and economic allies for Russia in the region. And the expansion of Moscow's trade ties with its neighboring countries shows that West Asia has been experiencing new changes for a long time. We now present you an article written by Samone Ekvan, a journalist and researcher with a PhD in international relations. The piece is titled, The US and the New Regional Order in West Asia. U.S. President Joe Biden began his first trip to West Asia as president, while the region is undergoing an unprecedented chain of fundamental and quick changes. The Russian special operation in Ukraine altered many world equations and the world order, but no one thought at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict that the first region whose order and security would undergo extensive changes would be West Asia. The Biden administration has repeatedly announced that West Asia is not among its priorities. Ukraine, China, and the midterm congressional elections in the United States are issues that exert more influence on his administration's decisions. However, the same issues, namely the U.S.-China relations, the conflict in Ukraine, and how to confront Russia eventually, pulled Biden back into West Asia so as to compel Saudi Arabia and other oil-rich countries in the region to increase their oil production, to resolve the energy security crisis in the world, and put an end to soaring prices in the United States and in Europe. The growing pressure on the Biden administration, including criticisms leveled at him for not resolving the energy crisis engulfing the U.S. through increasing domestic oil production, eventually convinced him to announce that the most important reason for his trip is not issues related to energy security, but rather the security issues of Washington's Arab allies and the Israeli regime. The trip was supposed to have a strong impact on regional security and order, yet a glimpse into the current processes and latest developments in the geopolitics of the region shows that Biden's move to forge an alliance between Arabs and the Zionist regime was a reaction to current changes rather than a creative move aimed at confronting Russia in the region. The issue is that West Asia had already been undergoing changes in terms of regional security and regional order long before Joe Biden decided to make his first trip to the region since taking office. The refusal of Arab countries in the region to join the United States in exerting pressure on Russia over Ukraine, the political conflicts between Moscow and Tel Aviv over the military presence of the Zionist regime in Syria, the emergence of new military and economic alliances for Russia in the region, and the expansion of Moscow's trade ties with neighboring countries shows that West Asia has been experiencing new changes for a long time. These changes, in terms of speed and timing, are potentially perilous for the United States and for Western countries. Russia's trade agreements with China and its other neighbors, the creation of a north-south corridor through Iran's route in the economic dimension, and the recognition of the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk by Syria and North Korea in the political dimension shows that Russia had a long time earlier launched its recruitment strategy in the region. But at that time, Biden was busy threatening Moscow with the membership of Sweden and Finland in NATO, as well as threatening Beijing to use the military in case of Taiwan. Before that, the disgraceful withdrawal of US from Afghanistan showed that the West Asia region is no longer important for the United States, but drastic changes cause heads to turn to this region once again. The reason as to why the Democratic administration in Washington realized too late the importance of the region in the field of international relations was because the Biden administration thought that the Arabs and the Zionist regimes getting closer to each other was a serious and burgeoning issue. However, analysts are of the opinion that this process is very slow and complicated due to widespread mistrust between the two sides, as well as among the Arab countries themselves. The announcement of the issue by Joe Biden and the Saudi media during his current trip to the region is by itself proof of this claim. The US administration was of the opinion that the Arabs and the Zionist regime getting closer to each other and creating a unified front against Iran, Tehran will eventually have to succumb to the US demands in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. And without economic benefits from the JCPOA, it will only be continuing the implementation of its obligations in the agreement. He believed that if pressures on Tehran worked, returning a small portion of the oil revenues to our country could solve the issue of regional rivalry forever and give the upper hand to the Zionist regime and its Arab allies. Nevertheless, the complication of the process of normalization of ties between the Arab countries of the region and the Zionist regime and the more active regional diplomacy of Iran that led to further and better economic relations between the countries of West Asia region and Iran, and even between Tehran, Beijing and Moscow, totally messed up the calculations of the White House about this region. In fact, it can be clearly stated that Russia's special operation in Ukraine, apart from changing the regional order in Eastern Europe and in Eurasia, showed its first consequences in West Asia, and hopelessly turned the United States' actions in the region towards aimless reactions or, at best, propaganda reactions. Oil prices jumped by several percentage points on Monday, 18th of July, after US President Joe Biden returned from his Saudi Arabia trip without getting firm assurances from Arab allies to boost crude oil supplies amid a severe shortage caused by sanctions on Russian oil. All major benchmarks were higher on Monday morning, with Brent crude, a benchmark for the purchase on global financial markets, rising more than 4 percentage points to $105 per barrel, bringing the prices back to above $100 a barrel after several months. On the second leg of his maiden trip to West Asia, Joe Biden joined leaders of several OPEC countries in the Saudi port city of Jeddah on Friday, 15th of July, for a summit, which was designed to lobby for a boost in oil production by the Persian Gulf periphery states in order to confront the turbulence in the global energy market. The US president, who vowed to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state during his election campaign in late 2020, was forced into a vault face amid a deeply worsening energy crisis after the US and its allies imposed unprecedented sanctions on Russia. In Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Joe Biden was welcomed with a fist bump by Saudi de facto ruler and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who, according to an investigation by the top American spying agency, was the mastermind behind the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Dashing his hopes, the kingdom and its regional allies refused to entertain Biden's demands, forcing him to head back to Washington virtually empty-handed. Talking to reporters in Jeddah, Joe Biden mainly mentioned energy while describing his meeting with the Saudi Crown Prince, but stopped short of commenting on whether he had received a firm pledge from the Saudi leadership on boosting crude oil supplies. Thus, the main question now is whether the regional order in West Asia is disrupted, or is the region moving towards an order in which the United States no longer has a role in causing disruption? It seems that the second question is more worthy of consideration and can be scrutinized in many international relations issues in academic circles and think tanks in the West as well as the region itself.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with
Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. And this hadith is about the visiting one another, visiting each other for the pleasure of Allah. This hadith enjoins us, it encourages us to visit one another for the pleasure of Allah. Imam Baqir alayhi salam says the following: pay visits to each other in your own homes, for verily that is a reviving of our teachings. So this hadith is interesting. Not only does it enjoin us and encourages us to visit one another, but it also emphasizes the fact that we should visit one another in our homes. So it's not like we go and visit one another, hey, you call up your friend and say, hey, let's meet up at the McDonald's and let's get, you know, something to eat. I haven't seen you in a long time. That's good. I mean, we're visiting one another, meeting one another for the sake of Allah. We'd also more recommended to go and visit the person in his home, right? So, you know, it's better to say, hey, I haven't seen you in a long time. Come over to my house, or let me come over to your house and we visit one another, right? This is a part of the Islamic teachings, a part of the Islamic ethics and ethos that we have been encouraged to revive. In continuation, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, and Allah has mercy on a servant who revives our teachings, right? So this is a part of the teachings of the a part of their sunnah, the part of their way. And by doing this, we are reviving it, meaning we are reviving their tradition, reviving their teachings. We're practicing their teachings. We're practicing their sunnah. And as the Imam says here, if somebody practices the sunnah and revives it and revives the teachings of the A'imma alayhimus salam, right, God has mercy on this person. In the same vein, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says the following about visiting one another. The Prophet said, he who goes to visit his brother in faith at his home without any motive on his part. And so he goes and visits his brother, he doesn't have any motive, he doesn't want to go and ask his brother in faith for a loan, right? He doesn't want to go there and ask him, you know, for some help or some assistance or, you know, for something. Rather, he just wants to go and visit him without any alternative, ulterior or personal motive. He just goes there because he loves him. The Prophet says, if such a person does this, it is recorded. This person is recorded as having visited Allah. And Allah honors his guest by his own right. Right? Meaning, if somebody visits Allah, it is the right of Allah, it is incumbent on Allah, he's made it incumbent on himself to visit to honor his guest, right? So if somebody visits, you know, his brother in faith, and it is as if he has visited Allah, and Allah honors his guest, then Allah would honor this person, would give him honor and magnanimity and respect in this world and in the hereafter. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtue of visiting one another for the sake of Allah in the words of Imam Baqir alayhi salam.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.